You are listening to the sixth season of the Just Powers podcast. I'm Dr. Sheena Wilson, principal investigator of Just Powers, and I'm joining you from Amiskwichi, Wisconsin, Beaver Hills House, colonially named Edmonton, where the University of Alberta is situated in Western Canada. I'm joined by Patrick Mann, our guest host for all eight episodes of the Reflector series.
Hello to our listeners, and thanks very much, Sheena. I'm joining you from Eastern Canada and the lands where Western University is located in London, Ontario, on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabeg, the Haudenosaunee, the Lenape Walk, and the Chinantan Nations, on lands connected with the London Township and the Sombra Treaties of 1796 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. The title of this podcast is Reflector 4, Storytelling. And it involves members of the SEF team, Lisa Moore, Sean Caulfield, Sheena Wilson, and myself, Patrick Mann. And the books we'll be discussing had input from Stephen Hoffman, Sue Kohlberg, Kameh Lim, and Sergio Serrano. In episode 4, we'll talk about a story collection and a children's book that we produced to probe questions as to how and why the imagination and storytelling are so important to furthering the challenging work that SEF is doing. We Were In It, the story collection, is a beautifully illustrated book with written contributions from a wide range of our team members and visuals by Kameh Lim. It was published by Memorial University Press in 2025 and edited by Lisa Moore and Sheena Wilson. The other book, Planet for Sale, is a children's volume for all of us, written by Stephen Hoffman in what we might call a Seussian style and illustrated with Sean Caulfield's darkly wondrous prints. It's a volume that has much to teach and will entertain you too. Be sure to check the episode description for links to our interactive resources so you can enjoy a visual encounter with these beautiful books as you listen to the podcast.
I can't wait to talk about storytelling today.
We've got some great storytellers that we're going to be joining shortly. And I was thinking it might be great if you just remind us who is Lisa Moore and who's Sean Caulfield, our special guest today.
You're so right, Patrick. We have so many storytellers on the Speculative Energy Futures Project, and we have just two of the storytellers that are representing teams here today talking with us. Lisa Moore, as many of you may know, is a very well-known and well-respected Canadian novelist and storyteller. She has many, many novels. I couldn't possibly list them all, but one that's dear to many of us on the team is February, which talks about the sinking of the oil rig off the Newfoundland shore. Her latest novel is This Is How We Love, and Lisa joins us from Newfoundland, where she teaches creative writing in the English department at Memorial University of Newfoundland and Labrador. Sean Caulfield is a very, very well-known artist and scholar based in Edmonton, Alberta. He's worked with Patrick many times over the years, and he's one of my colleagues here at the University of Alberta. He works with installation and sculpture and printmaking, and he considers the ways our environment is transformed by forces of urban and industrial growth. So those are the two people joining us today, and we'll talk a little bit about everyone who was on these various teams.
That's great, Sheena. Thanks so much. Yeah, so we're going to be focusing on the writing that we are publishing from the project, and specifically the collections that we're looking at are entitled They Were In It and Planet for Sale. So in this episode, we talk about a children's book and a story collection we produced to probe the question as to how the imagination and storytelling can be useful for the kinds of challenging work that we're attempting with Speculative Energy Futures. So to just give you a little hint about what We Were In It is focusing on, it's a 180-page book of creative fiction written by our team. One of the exciting things about the collection is that it involves writing by 14 members of the team. We produced 43 speculative stories about energy and energy transition, and they were beautifully illustrated by Kameh Lim, whose illustrations actually bring out, I think, some of the most exciting moments in what are often very kind of extravagantly or imaginatively constituted stories. Then with Planet for Sale, it's speculative fiction featuring lino and woodcut prints by Sean alongside poems and text written by Stephen Hoffman. And the book imagines a literal planet for sale in which our shared or perhaps common resources are depleted and destroyed by people acting in their own self-interest. Imagine that. Sheena, let's just kind of talk a little bit about what we're going to hear today, or maybe some of the ways we feel about what we're going to hear today, because we know what the audience is going to be hearing about. So Sheena, storytelling, what does it do? And I'm wondering if you were surprised at anything that we all got up to when we took it on as one of our approaches.
Well, storytelling is everything, right? I mean, Thomas King says it very famously, we are the stories we tell about ourselves, but I think he's not the only one to ever have uttered that phrase. You know, storytelling is how we make sense of the world. It was a great thing for me as somebody whose work is really involved with storytelling, whether that's documentary film or short experimental video making or creative nonfiction or scholarly writing, that writing became such a central part of the entire project. Because even though we're talking about these two projects today, many of the projects contain zines or poetry or other ways to tell story. They contain audio recordings and all sorts of things. So what was I surprised about perhaps in this project? Maybe I was surprised at the diversity of stories that we have to tell and the diversity of ways we tell stories when we get right down to it. And in some ways, how fast we can tell a story, right? At the end of the book, we were in it. There are four prompts. So if you're a teacher, or if you enjoy writing, or if you just want to give yourself that challenge, there's four prompts that are some variation of what was proposed to our teams during the workshops. And, you know, you can find out what stories you have to tell. And on any different day, it might be a slightly different story, but those same thematics keep coming through about the moment we're living in, this moment of converging crises, this moment of uncertainty. And there were so many vastly different ways to tell that story that were all each so valuable in their own way, and, you know, allow you to walk in the footsteps of the characters and the authors. So, I'm not sure that I was surprised by that as a literary scholar, but it was really beautiful to see the way in which we communicated differently through stories than we communicated when we were working academically as a team or working collaboratively in a room together. That when we told each other a story, it revealed a little different part of our own psyche, maybe, and our own understanding of our place in the world. So that was exciting and interesting for me. What did you notice, Patrick? Because you were involved also.
Yeah, it's true. And thanks for your thoughts, Sheena. I guess for me as a visual artist, I'm aware that sometimes we may be taking on what we think of as urgent questions, urgent problems. And perhaps, you know, we might feel as if we're getting in a little deep for perhaps our knowledge base, the kind of knowledge base that I as an artist might have. And I think that was doubly true when we got involved with storytelling. I consider myself somewhat of a writer, but I think Lisa really helped me and all of us to kind of draw out of ourselves some what I might think of as somewhat surprising observations that really kind of stand for where we sit in the world in relation to the kinds of things that we're talking about with this whole project. And I suppose that's something I wouldn't mind returning to with you after we listen to the podcast, or we give others a chance to listen to the podcast. You know, are there things that we took on with storytelling that really did help address the urgencies of energy transition in ways that we feel good about, or ways that maybe we wonder, you know, are these legitimate approaches to some of the urgent problems that we're dealing with?
One thing that surprised me with the children's story that Sean Caulfield and Stephen Hoffman and Sue Kohlberg put together, also I think there's some AR and VR interpretations of that done by Caitlin Fisher and her team at York University. But one thing that surprised me about that is, or not surprised me, but I thought was really beautiful about that was the way it took really complex economic philosophies about sustainability, right? Like Eleanor Ostrom's 8 principles, and made them accessible to, you know, not just children, but as in the Dr. Seuss mode, made this wisdom possible in a really distilled an accessible way for broad audiences. So that was also really great to see. You know, there's a way in which we affectively respond to these stories, and we can boil down the essence of what we're thinking about in a story that's very different from going into all the deep specificities and complexities of it in an academic essay. And I have to say, in my own, you know, my own history of work, that storytelling is often like the best way, really, to get really important and pressing information out into the world. So we hope everyone enjoys the stories and enjoys the podcast, right? I mean, like, it's so interesting to hear what they have to say.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things you're raising here, Sean really highlights later in the podcast, so people might want to be listening for his references to Eleanor Ostrom, I think are particularly kind of insightful. So yes, let's get to the podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm happy to be with you again today. And certainly I'm happy to see and hear Sheena again, and also to welcome Sean Caulfield and Lisa Moore. So today we're talking about storytelling, and we're going to be focusing on two published books, one entitled We Were In It, Very Short Stories About Energy, and Planet for Sale. And so we're going to be turning to Lisa and Sheena, who both worked on the We Were In It collection, and also to Sean, who worked with Stephen Hoffman on Planet for Sale. And what we want to do is focus on the question of how storytelling can be an imaginative tool regarding contemporary challenges such as we're facing regarding petrocultures and the need for energy transition. I'm going to begin by asking Sheena the question about how it came to be that speculative energy futures needed to have storytelling as part of its toolkit, and eventually, as we're saying, part of its flux kit. So, Sheena, could you talk a little bit about how that came to be?
Sure. Thanks, Patrick. It's great to see you, and you as well, Lisa, and you, Sean, this morning. How did it come to be part of the project? Well, I guess first, I teach a lot of writing, and we have a lot of really fabulous artists on the team, and I don't quite measure up. So my medium for doing creative work would be writing. And of course, I had this aspiration. I said, if speculative energy futures doesn't have some kind of literary output, I'll be really upset. And so it was very intentional that Lisa Moore was invited to be part of the project. And we're so happy that she's here with us, because being an award-winning Canadian novelist and a really great writing teacher as well, she has lots of experience doing this. And I would also just say that, you know, we shepherded that project, but there are many members of the SCF team that are in the We Were In It collection. I think there's about 15 of us in the end who submitted pieces, sometimes several pieces, to that collection. So it's a collection of short stories written by the Speculative Energy Futures team. So yeah, that's just one way of saying how we came to have literature and storytelling as part of our project. But I'm sure Lisa and Sean each have their own stories and perspectives on how that came to be.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sheena. So Lisa, it's great to have you here. And I'm going to be asking questions both as the host of this podcast and a secret writer myself, because I certainly admire your writing and have read lots of your writing. And so it's exciting to have been able to work with somebody like you on speculative energy futures. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your sort of method, or the way you came to the prompts that we worked with when we were working on the story collection. And it may not be typical that as a writer, you're working with groups who are really kind of circling around a particular theme. So, you know, how that sat with you and how you decided what you needed to do in order to get us all to kind of step up and be writers alongside you.
Thanks, Patrick. And you've written some fantastic pieces in this book, as you know. So it's really thrilling to be talking with all of you guys about story writing. I got involved with this group because there was a petroculture conference in St. John's, and I went out to dinner with Sheena and fell in love with her, along with a bunch of other people. And I thought, oh my gosh, it would be so great to be able to do this. But I teach at Memorial University, and I got that job as a creative writer. So I wasn't really sure if I was going to fit in with this crowd, because I'm not really a scholar in the strict sense of the word. But once I got to Alberta for the first gathering that I was able to go to, I realized that there were a whack load of artists and scientists and policymakers, and like, it was like a dream come true, actually, to get to work with people. And I believe that everybody has access to writing stories. I think it's the same as a heartbeat or drawing breath. But what I do when I'm teaching at Memorial is really focus on the elements of craft, such as creating characters, knowing how setting works, knowing how plot works, knowing about timing, all of those things. And then, you know, when Sheena said, but we've also got to talk about energy transition. You're right, Patrick. I thought, oh my goodness, how do you go about that? And of course, I'm from Newfoundland, which is, we're awash in oil in Newfoundland, where it's like that old ad for dishwashing liquid, Madge, you're soaking in it. We're soaking in oil. And in Alberta, of course, it's the same thing. So I thought about the idea of like, well, how does it touch down, though, really intimately in our lives? And that was the sort of starting place. Start with talking about craft, because that's something that everybody can get their teeth into, and then really ask the personal question of how it touches down really intimately in our lives.
Wow, thanks for that answer. And I remember as we worked on some of the prompts, things like personal memories and personal experiences in places that we go to. And of course, that was different for all of us individuals. Those were the kinds of things that were embedded in the prompt, so that I think it really sort of drew out of us our stories, or stories that became ours. When you think about working with us, there was a way in which sometimes you gave us a prompt that had a lot of to-dos on the list, and we only had a half an hour. So it felt a bit like you weren't necessarily telling us everything that one supposedly needs to know in order to be a writer. I'm just wondering more generally about this way of working with people, because obviously you've done it successfully lots of times.
I did. I did things in a 500 word piece. You've got to have a flashback going back 20 years. You've got to have a flashback going back 10 minutes. You've got to have a beginning, middle, and end. You've got to have conflict. You know, I just listed off all these parameters. And the reason for that is because people are terrified of the idea of writing fiction if they haven't really done it before. And this meant that they had so much to grapple with trying to hit those buttons that they didn't have time to be afraid. They just had to write. And the strange thing is that those kind of constraints, I don't know if I could ever write them myself or answer them myself, but everyone does. Like, and the fun of it is seeing, oh, look, there's the 20 years that went by in a sentence. And still what happens is through the side door, people's powerful memories and intimate stories are unleashed on the page, sometimes without them even realizing how they got there.
Yes. And I think that one of the things I really loved was you found a way to help us make the questions around this, around oil and around the need to kind of change our ways, to be personal questions. So I think it was a great strategy. So Sean, it's great to hear Lisa as a writer talk about how she came to working on a book for speculative energy futures. And I'm thinking regarding you, who's coming from a visual arts background, who's a very accomplished artist, how did it come to be that you and Stephen Hoffman decided to work on a children's book together?
Sure. I guess first and foremost, I would say, you know, the collaborative process itself has been just amazing for me. And I've been very grateful to work with Stephen Hoffman, and also our designer, Sue Kohlberg, who's been a big part of the project. We decided on a children's book for two reasons. One was simply that we like the idea of education, to talk about these issues. Education's a huge part of the whole picture, right? So a children's book, we thought, might be an interesting vehicle to do that. Secondly, Stephen Hoffman had a real interest in revisiting the story of the Lorax. So you might know this is a story from 1971, Dr. Seuss. Very well-known and early story that talks about ecology, environmental issues, and also the questions around how capitalism is a driving force or a factor in thinking about environmental issues. So he wanted to revisit that story, kind of rewrite it. And in his version, he takes a sort of a science fiction approach, and we move to a kind of dystopian planet where a person is trying to sell a planet that has been damaged by ecological mishandling. So that was sort of his vision, and I was delighted to kind of respond and work with him with imagery. One of the reasons we were both interested in The Lorax is it's also a retelling of a very, very old story, basically the story of visiting the underworld and seeing the future. So this has roots in Greco-Roman culture. It has roots in Christianity. And so the thinking there is that storytelling shapes our thinking over long periods of time, right? And how is this very, very old story being retold by Dr. Seuss and then retold by us also talk about the way we're framed in our thinking in ways maybe we don't even think about. So that was another important factor. So through all this, he wrote this story, and then I responded with imagery, and Sue Colbert responded with design and typography work, and we ended up with this. What initially is actually an artist book, so it hasn't been published as a trade copy yet. It's been produced as an artist book, and we're looking to make it a trade copy in the near future.
So, Sean, I'm going to ask you to actually read a couple of little excerpts from the book so we get a sense of the language, and so we'll give you a chance to do that. But since we're on the magic of radio, we're in a podcast, we can't see the wonderful illustrations you did. And I know that sometimes your work is dark, or it kind of shows us absurd images that can be quite provocative. So I wonder, you know, when you were making a children's book, how you thought of approaching the kinds of images that you were going to produce.
So I already kind of noted that the story itself looks back historically, and I have a long interest in the history of print and illustration. And so in making the imagery, I drew on a couple of sources. One was looking back to German woodcuts from the time of sort of Albrecht Dürer, which is an interesting period because in 1498, they thought the world was going to end in 1500. So thinking about, you know, times of change, it was interesting. But also then looking at Dr. Seuss, which has this wonderful illustration that it too, I mean, it's playful and whimsical, but it has a kind of dark quality as well. And I think children and all of us are drawn to imagery that sort of fluctuates and has multiple implications, right? So I tried to make imagery that read whimsical and fun initially, but maybe pointed to the darker issues that ecological change brings up.
Great. And I've certainly heard people talk about what children can manage when they encounter art, and they like to hear the truth and see the truth. So I think that seems to go along with your approach. I know that you've mentioned collaborators, and I know that Caitlin Fisher, who's also on Speculative Energy Futures, was part of your project. So do you want to talk a little bit about her contribution?
Yes, absolutely. Caitlin is another collaborator on the project, and she's been wonderful to work with. And she's bringing augmented reality to the project, and this is something that's somewhat new to me, but I'm really enjoying the way this, you know, kind of technology can animate the book in new ways. And I think, you know, given the complexity of the issues we face, having these sort of multiple voices in the book will be and is terrific. So what she's done is responded to my imagery, and then you can come to it with an iPhone or an iPad, look at the book, and it will actually be animated in a kind of magical, wonderful way that transforms the images and makes them pop out into your own space. So I love it, and I think it's really interesting, and it reminds me of the old tradition of pop-up books, which I think is an interesting quality that it brings.
Great. Thanks, Sean. Speaking of illustrations, Sheena and Lisa, the book, the story collection was amazingly beautifully illustrated by Cami Lim, who came to the project really after a lot of the writing had been done, maybe all of it. I don't even know the sequence of events. So I'm wondering if maybe Sheena, you could start. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that aspect seemed to kind of really sort of enliven the process? And Lisa, maybe you could talk a little bit about your response to the illustrations as well.
Yeah, we were very lucky to have Cami come onto the project at its later stage. And actually, we have Sean to thank for that, because Cami is a former student of Sean's, and he thought that she would pair nicely with the project. And her process was very, I don't know if the right word is devoted, but like she read each of the stories many times and really tried to engage with what people were communicating. So I felt it was, you know, really a special privilege to have I was like, what is she going to make for my story? Right. I wanted to see what she would produce, because it's really her interpretive visual representation of what she took from the story. So that was, you know, really wonderful. And that she works with a lot of color. So quite in contrast to Sean and Stephen's book, it's very bright and colorful. Her work has influences from Japanese artists, and we explain more about it in the introduction of the book. But yeah, it's been a real pleasure to work with her, and we're so thrilled about how the book looks now that it's completed. It's under review actually at this moment as a research creation piece, and we're hoping that it will be published soon and available to people. So Lisa, I don't know, you always have great things to say too about the work that Kemi is doing with us.
The colors are staggeringly beautiful. They're just so bright and sharp. And she talked about having a hyper fear of death when we spoke to her, and that the color, the brilliance of the color and the joy in the color was a kind of response to that, like a meeting that fear with joy, I think. It's not an illustration. It's really interpretation. I think there is a kind of difference. But it was really, she made those stories her own, and she added this meaning to the stories that was extra. Yeah, it's like a metaphor, really, like when two disparate things go together and create new meaning. That's what happened with Kemi's works of art, because they're tremendous works of art, each one of them. And the amazing thing about her was that she did this so quickly. There are 40 stories in the book, 40, and the cover design. And she just did these so fast, and they were astonishing.
Yeah, I think your analysis that her work really doesn't function the way we often think illustration does. I was thinking about that when we were putting up some images from the book in St. Gallen, and they really are like moments from the stories, but they're kind of exploded and they're extrapolated from. That's leading me, I don't know if it's a good segue, but it's leading me a little bit to a question about sort of meaning, maybe it's knowledge too. And I think we as people who work in universities, but are working in many cases in the arts, we're aware of this sometimes tension between creativity, between expression and knowledge. Lisa, I think I'll go back to you and just ask you, you know, you talked a little bit about some of the sort of angst around how to approach the energy transition piece. But as a writer, I suspect you're often aware that despite that you may be working very creatively, you're also communicating around ideas that have urgency and currency in the world in which we live. So do you want to just sort of pick that up and talk about it a little bit?
I think as the world gets a more and more dangerous place to be with climate crisis and so many other crises that we're facing, it becomes clearer to me that all art is political, and it's a matter of knowing what it is that you want to say in some ways. And it's, there is still a tremendous amount of art that comes from the subconscious, but it becomes impossible when you live in a place like Newfoundland, which had a boom and bust economy for so long, and we've teetered near the point of bankruptcy because of the development of Muskrat Falls, which is a hydroelectric mega project, that it is impossible not to talk about energy when I'm writing about where I come from. And I'm always writing about where I come from, whether even if I'm writing about somewhere else. And I had written a book about the Ocean Ranger, which was an oil rig that sank off the coast of Newfoundland in 1982. So I had already been writing about oil, even without realizing that I was writing about oil in a certain kind of way. So I did, you know, wonder, how do you approach this with a group of people who are really thinking about petroculture and energy transition and already deeply embedded in those thoughts and feelings? But when we began, it became easy to understand how to go forward, I think, because even though I'm from Newfoundland, and as I said, we're swimming in it, everybody is swimming in the climate crisis. Everybody knows it. Everybody has felt it in one way or another. So it is top of mind for everybody. Yeah, I think it was very natural in the end. I had no need to be afraid.
You definitely didn't, given the vitality of the workshops. Sheena, I know that you have lots of thoughts around this, and have also worked a lot with students around sort of narrative and we could say activism or engagement. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you think of narrative as a kind of a way into these big challenges?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about the first question you asked me about, you know, why writing, basically, why literature, why story in the SCF project? And I think one of the things is Imre Zeman, who co-founded Petrocultures with me, he writes about how oil has been invisible to us until a certain moment. Now we need to energy transition, and we're not even aware of where energy is in our lives. And so it's a really, I think these stories are really important because they're, you know, short stories. So they capture a moment, and each of these moments captures in some way how energy is embedded in our daily lived experience as we think about moving on to other ways of living, right? So there's, you know, there's things, everything from a power outage to stories about the convoy protest, right? And there's a way in which you can get into the minds and the shoes of the characters and really say, oh yes, energy is shaping my daily life, and my daily life is going to have to shift or change. Now, is that going to be for the better or the worse? Because we're thinking a lot about, you know, what the future of energy, so in other words, what our futures are going to look like. But the stories are often very strongly grounded already in our experiential lived realities. And we've turned those little snippets into something to give people a provocation, something for them to think about as they read through these various moments.
So Sean, as a visual artist, I wonder if you could talk a little more broadly about how you as an artist think about approaching these, you know, sometimes we call them wicked problems, think of really sort of taking on the world and yet also allowing the kind of creative desires you have and the creative license you hope to have as an artist, you know, how those things actually work together.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a difficult question, I think, in many ways. I think I sometimes contemplate this question in relation to ethics, in a way. And I mean by that, you know, problems of colonialism, problem of capitalism, they're tied to ways of looking at the world that are about a kind of means to an end, right? Everything's instrumentalized. And maybe art practice, in a way, I mean, I don't want to make it too mystical, but it's a way of dealing with the world where you kind of can be lost in a moment, lost in making, that has maybe a slightly different resonance with the world, right? And so it doesn't mean it's not political. I totally agree with the conversation. I think art is often always political in a sense, but I think this engagement with process or making or writing might have a different kind of spirit to it because you're so lost in the act of making. So in my own practice, I try to channel that kind of magic of art, if I could put it that way, and consider problems like energy transition in tension with that. And in other words, I think, you know, art can awaken in us a sense of value in each other and in the world around us because of the act of being creative. I hope that makes some sort of sense.
Yeah, that's great. And I really like the way you're talking about art as a way of challenging our kind of means ends thinking that our capitalist culture, you know, embeds in our experience daily. That also raises, though, the fact that we often, as artists, we pick up tools and ways of working and sometimes invert them. And so, you know, I think that with some of what you've been doing and we've all been doing, certainly, you know, these are challenges to some of the assumptions we may have around games, for example. And I know that there were other projects that happened in speculative energy futures. There were zines, and there we actually worked on a newspaper. And certainly with Janice and Curtis, we turned to Indigenous storytelling and Indigenous knowledge keeping as a really important source that, you know, is often not sort of foregrounded if we think about the ways that these challenges are communicated in the wider culture. So, you know, maybe we could have a little bit of a conversation around some of these other kind of modalities and methods that we used. Maybe Sheena, do you want to start talking about the newspaper? And Lisa, you could pick up on that as well.
Yeah, so the newspaper is a project still in the works, and every member of the team has contributed something to the ongoing draft of writing the newspaper. And we had Mike Bonanno come from the Yes Men and give us a workshop. That was one of the first things we did to try to pivot the project when COVID hit and we had to go online. That seemed a good way to go online together and a fun way to go online together. And we wrote collaborative stories together in those cases and broke off into teams. And then Lisa tried to help us turn them more into newspapers because I think, you know, we're stretching ourselves a lot, the members of the Speculative Energy Futures team. Some people don't consider themselves writers at all. Some people are used to being academic writers. And, you know, it seems like we were writing stories a little bit more with the newspaper. So Lisa was trying to help us sculpt them into newspaper reporting stories and get our headlines sorted out. And so that's still a work in progress. But, you know, those activist newspapers where you write a newspaper, this is the idea in the Yes Men, you write a newspaper set in a time period not too far into the future where what you speculate seems like it could be true. And then people see headlines they would like to see instead of the headlines they read in the newspaper every day. So we're going to take up that project at the very end when the team meets for a last gathering. This is our aspiration anyways, that we can make that happen, come together once the Flux Kit for Energy Transition is all put together and we've completed the Speculative Energy Futures edited collection and everything's done. We're going to get together and that'll be our one last group activity is, you know, in addition to a bunch of other things we'll do at the end, just finish up the newspaper and then fold it as a broadsheet into the top of the Flux Kit. And it'll be set about a year into the future. So it'll be set in about 2026, which actually I think is the date we picked. When we tried to speculate, it was just hard to imagine, you know, everything that's happened in the last 3 years, even. Lisa, do you remember some of the things from that workshop?
I was involved with a group that wrote about a bed-in on the lawn of the Parliament buildings. It was a protest. I can't remember what the protest was for, but I do know that I brought blankets and pillows out onto a square of grass and set up like lamps and took a photograph so it would look like I was in bed on, you know, a patch of lawn, which I was hoping that somebody would Photoshop in front of the Parliament buildings, which I'm not sure ever happened, but I was talking to someone and Sheena, I forgot to tell you this. I was talking to someone. I said, you know, we're planning to parody the national newspapers. And someone said, you know, I bet they would run it.
Oh, that would be, wouldn't that be just the coolest thing?
Yeah. The other thing is, of course, we were new to meeting each other at the time and we were new to writing and we were new to figuring this thing out. I'm not a natural satirist, and this required satire skills. So for me, it was also difficult to do a satire of a paper. And of course, we were living in times where real life was more satirical than anything you could possibly come up with. But now that we are such amazing writers, I feel like if we could just get together physically, we could do the whole thing in a day, because that's the way journalists do it, right? They just pump it out. And I think we're there. And then we just send it to that national newspaper and get them to print it.
That is just the best idea. My goodness, that'd be fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, this resonates with me in relation to the fact that just the other day, I heard a thing on CBC talking about climate scientists working with comedians. And so the comedians are actually trying to sort of figure out how to adapt their way of working. I mean, in comedy, you can use anger, but there's certain kinds of things that don't really fit if you're trying to actually kind of get a point across. So one of the examples of something you could say is, I used to like it when the weather was the boring part at the end of the news instead of the part that makes me not sleep at night. And on the other hand, there's certain things you kind of couldn't say because fundamentally they don't get the point across that this is all of our problem. So there's a way in which I think we all, as we engaged with, let's call it research creation and writing and the visual, we all tried to sort of think about how you sort of skew towards something that's going to be useful without losing what you do. And Sean, I think that I'm interested in, you know, we'll get you, as said, to read from the book. But, you know, when you were looking at what Stephen was doing to sort of paraphrase, or I don't think parody is the word, Dr. Seuss, et cetera, did you have conversations about how that was going for him?
Well, a couple of things that I remember is, one is his desire to rhyme like Dr. Seuss. So even that has a kind of structure that you'd have to respond to. It sounds simple, but it's, you know, and rhyme in the kind of language of, right, was an interesting challenge, I think, for him, but one that was very enjoyable. So I would say kind of went back and forth. The other thing, though, of course, is he did all of this with the goal of distilling the work of a very kind of important economist, Eleanor Ostrom, and her work on the commons. And so it's, I think, terrific that he's written this playful piece, but one that actually is focused on a very kind of complex intellectual question around the commons and how we deal with the commons and Eleanor Ostrom's response to that and her vision that, well, not her research, demonstrated that there are modes of dealing with the commons that have to do with community and aren't necessarily tied to ownership or state governance. So this playful approach, use of rhyme, but actually a very intellectual and complex subject, I think was an interesting merging.
That's a really helpful comment and really important for us to know. And it makes me think also that I think what we were all also invested in was doing what we love. And just because we want to save the world and we want to ensure that energy transition is successful doesn't mean we can't do what we love. And so, you know, it's been really wonderful to hear each of you talking about the ways that you approach this so that, you know, we hold on to what matters to us as humans. But obviously, if we want to hold on to our place in the world, we also have to work pretty hard to integrate the kinds of things we do as artists with the knowledge and with the arguments that need to be made around our subject.
This project really underscored for me the amazing power of interdisciplinary work and collaboration. I would never in a million years have thought about Eleanor Ostrom if, you know, I wasn't working in collaboration with someone in another discipline in political science, right? So I'm so grateful for that. But at the same time, a kind of acknowledgement of specialized knowledge also functioning. So the kind of bounce back and forth between, you know, working across disciplines and then working in depth within one's own discipline, I think was really interesting for me. And I think it comes up in a lot of the projects in the broader speculative energy future kind of initiative.
So maybe we could have a few little excerpts from the books.
So this is from the introduction that Sheena and I wrote together, and I think it shows how we got to work. We were looking for short and quick, something as slick as oil, but against oil, something with the promise of a short circuit, a power breaker, a spray of sparks from the outlet, a way out, an outage. We tried to speculate about the future, but the past and the present left an oily residue, the greasy fingerprints of the things that had gone wrong and were still going wrong. We wrote them down. We met over Zoom, made possible by an interconnected chasm of precious minerals gouged from the breast of the world. Sometimes our screens froze, especially when we all left our cameras on, or when we weren't muted. When someone's screen froze, her face melted. Her jaw slewed to the side, a plastic howl of pixel jitter. We learned we were made of little tiny constellations, just dust, and nothing could last. We were lined up in boxes next to each other, and the slewing was about impermanence, and we briefly came to terms with it. But our understanding couldn't hold. We were chasing our way out of the ending. The screen persisted, though we tried to leap out of it. We wanted what we wrote to touch people. Lasso the cables of connectivity, the great welter of, and then this, and then this. We wrote it down.
That's great. Thank you.
So this passage of writing, as I mentioned, Stephen was looking to distill the points of Eleanor Ostrom. So this is at the end of Planet for Sale, where he distills her work into 8 points. So it begins with, how do people save planets from unnecessary mess? It's really quite easy. 8 principles for success. 1, we must know which things need our protection. 2, give more than we take from this vast things collection. 3, rules for sharing that we make together. 4, takers are watched and their taking is measured. 5, cheaters are punished when they break the rules. 6, Fights are stopped quickly with fight-stopping tools. Number 7, we win recognition from high-ranking folks. And number 8, we connect our system to other system with spokes.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, this is flower power. People said they saw a green flash and then heard an explosion. But Newfoundland Power came out and said they had a spokeswoman, and the woman said the explosion was normal. She said it sounds loud when the steam escapes, like a bang, she said. 2 days later, 100,000 people without power, rolling blackouts. Charlene and Mike couldn't make coffee. He was down in the basement at the pipes with the dessert blowtorch she had been given for Christmas because she once told her mother-in-law she loved creme brulee. But she had never made creme brulee. Her in-laws had gone down into their basement to sit near the oil furnace with their white plastic patio chairs. They were wrapped in duvets in the dark. The rest of the house was like a block of ice, her mother-in-law said. You can see your breath. Mike used all the propane in the dessert blowtorch, thawing the pipes, or one pipe. He shimmied into the crawl space, lying on his back in the dirt, and he could smell mouse shit and dry wood and something garbagey. A cobweb had landed over his eye socket. He rubbed it off and felt the gritty feel of it between his fingers and thumb. He held the dessert torch close to the pipe. The condensation on the outside of the pipe had frozen in barely raised beads, but the flame melted the condensation and drove the rivulets of water in zigzagging paths. He had Charlene's book light, and he held the skinny, bendable neck between his teeth. A Christmas bulb had escaped the storage box, and he'd crushed it with his thigh, and splinters were sticking into his leg. He was jammed pretty tight between the cold dirt floor and the joists. Mike yelled up the stairs to Charlene, the book light still clamped between his teeth. Try it now. And she shouted, what? Now, he screamed. Try it now. A string of his saliva blew in front of the single bluish beam of the tiny light. He drew a deep breath and shouted, now! And she turned the ornate faucet handle with the faux porcelain word that said cold written on it and held the Tupperware jug under the faucet, and she heard the distant clotting gurgle from deep down in the subconscious of the house.
Amazing. Thank you.
Beautiful. In the collection of stories at the very end, just as there was when we had the installations, there's the possibility to write your own stories, right? So Lisa has shared the prompts or versions of the prompts that we used in the workshops. So people can use them with classrooms. They can use them for themselves as writing prompts to think about how they might want to write about energy. So we just want to put that out in the world so that there's even more stories. There are even more stories created in the world around these kinds of very important issues, because we all have something to say about energy transition.
I want to say too that like the works that people wrote were honestly quite astonishing. Like there are beautiful, beautiful stories in this collection, and they're all beautiful in their own way. I mean, there's 40 stories. They're short, most of them. Some of them are longer, but they're little nuggets, little gems of, you know, brilliant imagery and dialogue and action. And I think they do really capture what it feels like to be in the present moment and worried about what's going on with our world. I think they do capture that in a beautiful way.
I absolutely agree, Lisa. And I think that one of my experiences of doing that project was that because we have this shared commitment and we've been working together for a while and had been when we got to that point of doing the fiction workshops, there was a kind of intimacy, and yet we still each had to go off camera and write and try and come up with something. And it was also quite fun. I mean, not nervous making to actually share what we were saying. And so I think it was all part of it. You know, it was really an amazing kind of sharing and learning process that I think generated some wonderful work, as you say.
Yeah. And I think it was really brave of people. Like, it's a terrifying thing to say, okay, you've got 30 minutes, come back, and you're going to read to however many people are on the screen. And it was, you know, between, I guess, 15 and or 25 or something. And people did it. People read what they had. And sometimes they said, oh, I didn't get very far. Or sometimes, like, what they read took our breath away after 30 minutes. So I think that was super exciting. And as a group, like, if your story didn't work out on that particular workshop, you know, it would work out on some other workshop. But we got to experience everybody's moment of triumph as a group triumph in a way. I think that was created a kind of collectivity.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, as with so many things around COVID and our need to adapt, you know, I always hate sort of celebrating the wonders of Zoom, but there's no question we might not have done that project in that way had it not been for the need to adapt and use this medium. So for sure, I think something came to be that might not otherwise have happened in such a way.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation, and it was a terrific experience for me to reflect on these projects again in this context.
Yes, very nice talking to all of you. Made me think in new ways about what we've managed to do over the last few years, even and despite and perhaps because of COVID and Zoom. So great talking to you.
I just want to say how much I've enjoyed hearing you do storytelling about storytelling. And I really do sort of love talking about art and love talking about how it works. And so it's been a real honor and a pleasure to hear all of you sort of ruminate in ways that I think are incredibly productive, but also inspiring. So thank you.
So I really enjoyed hearing that conversation again. There's so much rich material there. And one of the things that I was struck by is the fact that, in a sense, these stories, these books that we've been talking about, they become tools that have value both for an individual reader, but also for getting ideas and messages out into the world in kind of innovative and sometimes playful, humorous ways. The other way that I think that some of these ideas and the specifics of the books that we've been talking about are going to make their way into the world is with the Flux Kit. And that's something that we might want to just kind of tell listeners about a little so that they'll understand what the mechanism is that we're using in order to actually distribute this work. And also what ways that they themselves might actually kind of activate some of what they're hearing here. So do you want to say something about your way of describing the Flux Kit, Sheena?
You know, the Flux Kit is a do-it-yourself aesthetic box, but it's actually, in our case, been highly curated. But inside of it, each of the objects is there to be activated. Each of the Speculative Energy Futures projects is a call to action. And so specifically in terms of these stories, you know, you can activate them in multiple different ways. You can read Planet for Sale in a public space. You can write your own version of Planet for Sale. And with the We Were In It collection, you can read and share and discuss these stories and the complexities that they present. But also there are the four prompts at the end of the book that give insights into how to begin writing your own stories individually in a writing club or a book club or a classroom space or individually on your own. And then start sharing those stories. If we're going to do something about climate change, the doing can't always be in the same mode, right? So sometimes that doing is going to be about telling the story of what it means to live through this moment, or tell the story of what we want the future to be like, or tell the story of how we got here. And so these prompts are an invitation to join us, to do that, to share your stories, to send them to us. We'd be thrilled to receive stories from people using the Flux Kit. So all of those are possible ways to take action on climate change and imagine more just futures, or, you know, at least more livable futures while the ship is sinking. That's often the way I think of it. So not to be morbid on our final note there, Patrick, but that's what I'm thinking.
No, and in fact, I think that in as much as there's a lot of important work to do, and I think the Flux Kit really kind of reminds us of that, it also has a certain magic about it. It's purpose designed with all the projects within it. And so I think for multiple generations, you know, there are opportunities to really engage. And again, it's not all happy work, but I think a lot of what's possible with the the kind of creativity that the Flux Kit really encourages, is about thinking together, working together, and kind of exploring together some of the big challenges and some of the other kinds of questions that come along with thinking about energy transition and the future.
Well, it was great to think with you today about storytelling, Patrick. And yeah, I hope everyone enjoys these books that we've produced over quite a number of years. And there's been a lot of research and a lot of thought that went into them. And we hope you take that and run with it and activate it in all the ways that are possible.
So thanks, Sheena. And we thank all of you listeners. We hope you'll join us for the next podcast, which is going to be dealing with, you might call it, gaming culture. And so that's a little hint as to what you'll hear from Speculative Energy Futures, the Reflector series next. And we thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the sixth series of the Just Powers podcast, Reflector, on the topic of speculative energy futures, which uses research creation as an interdisciplinary method for approaching climate justice and energy transition. Be sure to visit the Just Powers website at justpowers.ca, where you can learn more about speculative energy futures and explore the Flux Kit. You will also find information about our ongoing projects and access to more resources. This podcast is made possible by support from Future Energy Systems Canada, the First Research Excellence Fund, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, the Cool Institute of Advanced Study, the University of Alberta, Alberta Eco Trust, and the City of Edmonton. Special thanks to our guest host, Patrick Mann. This series was co-produced by myself, Sheena Wilson, Patrick Mann, Katie Lewandowski, and Sarah Taylor. Post-production was provided by Story Darling Studios in Edmonton, Alberta. This episode was edited by Sarah Taylor, CCE, and Blair Drover, mixed and mastered by Tony Bao, and music from Artlist.